Rita misses North Florida, but not COVID. Cases and hospitalizations are once again on the rise. There's more pushback around town to Shad Khan's Lot J deal. And JEA has a new CEO. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. It's 549-2937. Call up now. Then later, how you can be part of WJCT's Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive all this month. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times-Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. Mike Mendenhall of the Jax Daily Record is here. Hi, Mike.
Good morning, Melissa.
Regular contributor Fred Matthews. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning. And rounding out our foursome, writer-journalist Claire Goforth. Hi, Claire.
Happy Friday the 13th.
That's right. And we'll get into that. Lots to talk about this week. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest numbers on the coronavirus pandemic. In Thursday's daily report, the State Department of Health reported 5,607 new cases of COVID-19. That means now 863,000 and change Florida residents have an active case of coronavirus. That includes more than 300 new cases here in our area. And the death toll in Florida from COVID stands at 17,372, including several new cases in our area. We're going to begin by talking about this because here's some good news. Tropical Storm Eta missed us for the most part as it blitzed its way across the state. Although schools did close yesterday in case the storm was bad, some COVID testing sites also closed for the storm. But we're going to talk about these coronavirus numbers before we get into the other news of the week. We want you to give us a call. It's 549-2937. The number of people being admitted into the hospital because of COVID-19 is on the rise across Florida. It went up about 40% in the last month. Health leaders say now is the time to act before things get out of control. They're really sounding the alarm this week louder than ever because school is back in session. The state is completely opened. Major holidays are right around the corner where people want to gather. This could jumpstart another big wave of COVID community spread. The last thing we need to see is hospitals unable to deal with the demand. Claire Goforth, you just tweeted me as we talked about the show, pointing out that the last Friday, the 13th roundtable that we all met in person before the pandemic hit was Friday, March 13th. That is how long we have been in isolation, socially distancing, not allowing guests into our building here at WJCT, wearing masks, doing all of the protocols to try to ward off coronavirus among our staff and our contributors. And so I'd like to begin with you, Claire. After most of the year dealing with this and people so tired of this, understandably so, the worst thing we could do right now is let down our guard, according to these new numbers.
Well, yes. I mean, we're looking at the numbers increase substantially nationwide and locally. I don't mind sharing that I was exposed to COVID a week ago and am now isolating at home with no symptoms and waiting for a positive or negative test. Hopefully it will be negative. I should find out today.
I hope so.
Thank you. And I mean, we've been very careful. I think that everyone is tired of staying home and staying safe, as we say, but it is quite disconcerting to see how there are some people who continue to live in denial about the pandemic, the anti-maskers, if you will. And there are, to be honest, there are some people who represent us politically, from the president on down, who encourage such behavior. This is not going to do us any favors as we move forward. And yes, we have gotten a lot better at treating the disease, but it remains a deadly disease. It is incredibly contagious. The person who I was in contact with, it was a very close friend in the so-called pod, and they tested positive after spending 20 minutes in an indoor setting with someone else who was wearing a mask, both of them in masks. So, I mean, this is an incredibly contagious virus.
So you traced your exposure to an indoor setting where people had on masks, but still it spread.
it was two people, not myself. Two people in an indoor setting with masks on for 20 minutes, and it still spread.
Yeah.
You know, this is to be taken very seriously. And with Thanksgiving approaching, I mean, my family has just canceled their Thanksgiving, which I was not going to travel to anyway. And I think that a lot of people need to reevaluate their plans based on what we're seeing from the virus.
Yeah. Fred Matthews, you know, the CDC released updated mask research this week showing that mask wearing does reduce the transmission, although, as Claire just pointed out, it's not 100% effective. It's just been so frustrating to watch this play out in Florida, where the governor is adopting what essentially amounts to a herd immunity strategy. He hasn't called for universal mask wearing. Businesses are left up to their own devices as to how many people they'll allow inside an establishment. I know one couple that decided to go out to dinner at a very nice restaurant just over the line in St. Johns County last week. If you're in Duval County, you're more likely to see mask wearing because the mayor here has called for a mask mandate. Nothing like that in St. John's. They both tested positive for COVID-19 shortly after going out to dinner at a restaurant in St. John's County where there was no restrictions at all. It was just as if it was before the pandemic, completely packed indoors, dozens and dozens of people, nobody wearing masks except the wait staff. And so they will try to make sure that they're going to try to establish that that's where they got the virus. But that's just one example of what we're dealing with, Fred. And it's not a pretty situation.
It is not, and it is unfortunate that here in Florida and, of course, nationally, we simply don't have political leadership that is willing to just tell people the simple facts of what needs to be done. Wearing a mask is the first line of personal defense that we all have. I do a lot of volunteer work among seniors in particular. I'm in that high-risk group, and it is still amazing to me among many of my senior friends, many of them conservative, who follow Fox News religiously. Many of them have simply bought into this business of, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen. I don't want to be restrained. I want to do what I want to do. You can't make me wear a mask if I don't want to wear a mask. I'm going to shake hands and I'm going to hug and I'm going to do all this stuff that I'm going to do. And if you get it, you get it. And unfortunately, among many people, this is the attitude that they have. I often hark back to my time in the Far East, in Japan and Korea in particular. Wearing a mask there is not new.
Yeah.
When I was there from 71 to 73, and I might have mentioned this before, that whenever somebody got a cold or you went into the subway, everybody wore a mask going into the subway because, you know, you didn't know who got a cold. And it wasn't unusual. It wasn't anything prohibitive. It was just good sense. And that's where we have to be now. And unfortunately, until we get leadership from top down, I think we've done a reasonably good job here in Jacksonville. But until we get that leadership top down that says universally, this is the first line of defense, we're going to be in for a tough next few months with this COVID crisis.
Yeah. David Bauerlein, on Thursday, health investigators reported this cautionary tale from the summer. They traced an outbreak to a summer wedding in Maine. There was a wedding reception at a small town in Maine. It led to three separate COVID-19 outbreaks that infected 178 people, put three more into the hospital, and killed seven people. And here's the shot. None of those seven people who died attended the reception. And so they're citing this as an example of trying to remain vigilant as we head into the holiday season, not going to big family gatherings, not having get-togethers as much as you might want to, as much as you might miss your loved ones, David.
Right. That would be, if you're indoors, then the chances of spread are much greater. Even here regionally, that's going to be an issue, We have seen in the past week there's been higher infection rates in St. John's and Clay County. They're both above 10% on some days. So even though Duval County has been below 10%, it's been trending up as well. The virus does not stop at county lines. And to your point, Melissa, it also does not stop within the confines of any particular event. It's a highly contagious disease. And the old expression, 7 degrees of separation. This is a virus that travels so 7 degrees and ends up with people getting infected who were not actually at the, quote, super spreader event. But because it's so infectious and so contagious, it has a wide reach, and we're certainly seeing that. And what's happened in the Midwest and the upper Midwest is it's winter there. People are indoors more. We're going to have our own version of winter. It's not going to be as long, but it's going to have an impact as well on the virus right here, as well as just as community gatherings and family gatherings where you're all indoors. People should probably think about that. And if they are going to do it, make sure they're taking all the precautions they can possibly take.
That's right. And let me, if I could, get the updated guidance out this week from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC is reminding everyone that wearing a face mask doesn't just protect other people around you from potential infection. It protects you too. They say there's growing evidence that wearing a mask helps you. That's new guidance, Mike Mendenhall, because when this pandemic was first taking hold, we were told wear a mask to protect others. Now they're saying they think it will also offer you, the wearer, some protection.
Yeah, that's right. And Dr. Anthony Fauci was actually making the rounds on many national publication or national news shows recently promoting that idea that masks do add a layer of protection for the individual, and it just makes it even more important that that we wear those face coverings to mitigate spread of and transmission of COVID-19. I think it's also worth noting too that beyond just the general public health, I mean, the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting public policy both at a national and at a local level. With one of our local city council members, Scott Wilson, contracting COVID-19 last week, it pushed back. It caused cancellations of city council meetings, which is going to be pushing back one of the largest pieces of legislation that council's considering, the funding of Lot J, which we'll talk about later. But that's a real thing to consider. And Governor DeSantis actually let an executive order expire on November 1st, allowing for totally virtual public meetings. And now that that's expired, a lot of these public officials, they have to at least have a hybrid meeting, and so that there's a lot of them that are meeting in person, and that not only increases risk for them, but it also increases risk for the public who may want to participate in those meetings as well.
Let's go to your calls as we talk about the uptick in COVID-19 around the state. And some other news coming up with our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts. Do you have COVID fatigue? What are your COVID questions? Steve is on the south side. Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to recommend let the people that are not afraid return back to the way their lives have been and just have people wear a mask. But open up field hospitals outside of every major city like MASH in the military, and have them flown out there so they could be isolated and quarantined and get the fresh air they need, and they'll be safer like that. And then everybody else can go to work, and we save the economy and everything. It's that simple.
All right, Steve. Claire, when this pandemic first got underway in the spring, they were talking about setting up field hospitals because they were so worried that there wouldn't be enough ICU beds in this city to handle the demand. That did not happen. The hospital systems around town so far anyway have been able to handle the COVID load, the COVID patients. Although when we do look at the numbers, they could get close to capacity at some point here at the end of the year or in January if the numbers keep going the way they're going.
I think that's what we're all worried about, that we're going to see not only an increase in cases of people who may be asymptomatic or have not enough symptoms to necessitate a stay in the hospital, but that we're going to see an increase in the load in the hospitals themselves, particularly in the ICUs. One of the things about COVID is that it is really unpredictable, although statistically speaking, the elderly and at-risk population, people with certain pre-existing conditions are more likely to necessitate a hospital stay. It can happen to anyone, and I don't think that logistically your caller's point to field hospitals outside of the city is an idea that we could actually put into play,
yeah,
because of all of the equipment that would be necessary. But I think that there's a very real chance that in Jacksonville and other major cities particularly, that we may start seeing an overflow of our ICU beds. And then what do we do? Then what happens when the question becomes, well, do we have enough ventilators? Are we going to put this person on a ventilator or that one? And they have to start deciding based on a judgment of who's going to survive. Nobody wants to see that happen, which is why, although it is frustrating, I mean, I went to the testing site in the Regency mall area, and on one side of the mall, they had a food bank delivery pickup, and on the other side was the testing facility. And the testing facility, I was stunned to see how many people were there, quite frankly. And there was a very long line for the food bank as well. So, I mean, the economic concerns are not without merit, but if people are dying and people are sick, that is also going to have a substantial impact on the economy, not to mention the interpersonal impact that will have on people in terms of suffering and long-term health risks. And there's no easy answers here, but, you know, we have to think of our fellow man.
Here's a tweet from a listener. We went to the DMV in Baker County yesterday. We were the only people there wearing masks. It's insane to see people acting like there is nothing going on. I'm glad we were only inside for 10 minutes. Another tweet from Kevin pointing out from NBC News that on November 1st, the U.S. had 76,000 new coronavirus cases for the day. By November 12th, it had basically doubled to 161,650 cases of COVID. The numbers are just going up and up is the point here. Mead in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Mead. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling to find out why we're not studying the data that's being presented to us, analyzing it more specifically about when people are passing away, what is exactly they're passing away from, what were their comorbidities, why aren't people talking about the people that survive and why they survive and how they survive, and why aren't we talking about supplementation, knowing that D3 is one of the supplements doctors recommend, doing the research that people with D3 levels above 65, 70 have less severe symptoms from the COVID if they do get it. Why
yeah.
aren't we talking about diet and exercise? So
I am happy to talk about that, Mead, and I appreciate you bringing it up. Let me just say on a personal note, I take vitamin D every single day in order to boost my immune system so that I can stay healthy for my family. I take a lot of other supplements too, to protect and boost my immune system. And I encourage everyone to do that right now, especially. Now, Mead mentioned comorbidities. Fred, there is a relationship between pre-existing conditions or health issues and COVID-19. Older people, overweight people, people with some kind of health or immune system issue, they are more likely to die of this virus. But, and this is an important but, not always. Perfectly healthy people with no health issues that they bring to the table have died from this virus, including healthy children sometimes. So I appreciate Mead's point, though, in that this is a time when if you are able to take steps to boost your immunity and be as healthy as you possibly can, you need to be focusing on that.
Exactly. I join you with the D, with the vitamin D supplement. I'm one of those who takes it all the time. But It is one of the key difference here, and there are people who are studying the data behind it, those who are passing away from additional ailments aside from catching COVID-19. So that data is being compiled. But the problem that is facing us, that is facing all of us right now, and is facing, is that we are facing a pandemic that we need, that we don't have a vaccine for. We've made it through the different levels of the flu, and to the president's credit, to an extent, this is almost like the flu. But the big difference is that we don't have a vaccine for it, and we need to work on a preventative for it. And until we can get to the level of a vaccine and have enough people who are willing to take the vaccine and understand what the side effects of that is, we have to deal with the preventative measures that are that we have available to us now. And that's the educational project that is facing us. We've got to deal with the preventative issues that are facing us right now, and for those who have those conditions, asthma, your age, diabetes, any of the underlying conditions, you know you're at risk. For the rest of us, we have to do things in consideration of others. And that's really what we're talking about here. Have some consideration of others as well as yourself, so that until we get to a level where we have ability to actually prevent this through vaccination means or others. And that's just what's facing us right now.
That's right. I'm going to take one more call on this, then we'll move on to some other news from the week. Vicki in St. Augustine. Hi, Vicki.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning. I think it comes down to two things in my perspective. It's one is just kind of common sense, being educated since March on the dangers of this thing and having some common sense. I see a lot of folks on social media living their lives as normal, going out to restaurants, going to theme parks, going to museums. Kind of blows my mind. And then the other thing is exactly to his point, the gentleman, a character, what kind of character you are and have. You might not be at risk, but we all know at this point what we can do to protect those who are. And I'm glad the CDC finally came out and said that it's also to protect yourself. Maybe that will bring the point home to those folks who are more interested in themselves than others. Sad it has to come to that point. But yes, be a good person. It's that simple at this point.
I know.
Be a good person. Protect your grandparents. Protect your parents. Protect your coworkers. You wear a mask. I've been wearing a mask since March. I own a meal delivery business. I don't even think about it anymore. I put it on first thing in the morning. End of story. I don't think about it. I hope you have a great day. Enjoy your weekend. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Vicki. Thanks for that. Yeah, everybody, just wear the mask, please. We beg of you. It's our Friday roundtable, 549-2937. And we're going to move on and talk about some other news and notes. Also making headlines this week. Did you hear about this one? Jaguars owner Shad Khan says he wants to build a Four Seasons hotel downtown on the current site of Metropolitan Park. This from team president Mark Lamping. Now, Khan owns a Four Seasons in Toronto, and he would own this one as well. Very high-end hotel. This is all part of his ambitious plan for a mixed-use development on Lot J next to the Jaguar Stadium. At the same time, watchdog groups like Our Jacks are speaking out about the deal. They say City Council needs to exercise more oversight into giving Mr. Khan hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money to bring his vision to life. David Bauerlein of the Times Union, as you report, the city auditor has also found that the return on investment would be only 44 cents in value for every dollar spent on Lot J. That's much lower than what the mayor's office and the Jaguars are claiming. It's 549-2937 to talk Lot J. David, tell us if you can, everything you've learned in the last day or so about this potential deal.
So there's two different parcels that are being talked about. But for Lot J, that's the one, the parking lot next to the football stadium. That's going to be coming up for a vote probably by December 8th. Matt Carlucci, the council member, is going to put forward a amendment that would try to get the entire deal put back into further review by the Downtown Investment Authority, which at this point has not been part of anything in negotiating that deal. It's been done through the mayor's office. So there's a possibility that he'll get support, but that seems like an uphill climb probably. So that seems to be moving forward, and it's a huge, huge amount of money. I know there's a lot of moving pieces to it. There's a lot of looking at clawbacks and ownership rights, etc. But the overriding issue is that you have up to $233 million in taxpayer dollars going into a project that just blows out of the water any amount of money that the city has ever committed to a public-private deal in downtown or really anywhere else in the city. So it's a huge, huge amount of taxpayer money at stake.
Yeah, Mike Mendenhall, you've been covering this too. How do you see this shaking out? Matt Carlucci on the city council is now saying that the Downtown Investment Authority should get review of this project, and that kind of begs the question, why wasn't that done to begin with?
Yeah, Melissa. So the legislation that was proposed by the mayor's office actually waives several public waives several policies in the city ordinance, which requires the Downtown Investment Authority to review some of these development agreements that are within their jurisdiction. So, and of course, Lot J and TIA Bank Field, that area is within the downtown overlay, and it also requires less detail about final costs and final investment for the REV grant, which is essentially a tax refund on the residential portion that's being proposed for Lot J. The bill itself, I mean, that it's really giving pretty much total control of the approval process to the city council. That's what Matt Carlucci is attempting to strip from the bill. He wants that independent vetting process from the DIA, which typically would review a project of this scope.
549-2937, Jason in San Marco. Hi, Jason. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've called before. As you know, I'm opposed to the Lot J plan. And just a couple other things I want to add in. The stadium isn't, I believe it's called an enterprise zone. So whoever can pull off something there tends to get a really great deal. It's not talked about a lot, but that was changed, the zoning there. The other thing is that I assume that the Four Seasons is a corporation and that Shad Khan has to get approval from them as well. And I'm just not sure it makes sense to put the premier hotel in Jacksonville in between the jail and Talleyrand, especially when we have the giant parcel sitting across the river, the district, where that never materialized on the old JEA site. That'd be a lot better site for it. I'm just giving you my personal opinion. And the last thing I want to say is that the Omni is available. And with a lot of serious upgrades, you could make the Omni a very nice Four Seasons. And it's sitting there already built. Those are my points of view. Thank you for hosting.
All right. Thank you for lots of points from Jason. Claire, go forth. Let's go through those points, including the fact that what Shad Khan is saying is that the Four Seasons is such a top shelf brand that it will attract excitement, revenue, foot traffic, other businesses. Now, that said, you and I know full well, working here in the Urban Core for many years, that even the Omni Hotel, which is a pretty nice hotel, they have not always been able to keep that hotel full. So if a hotel with a price point of $200 a night or something like that struggles in these times, how is a hotel where you pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars a night going to make it in this downtown footprint? I think that's a reasonable question to ask. And also the fact that the city hasn't done a feasibility study on all of this yet either, I think that's worth bringing up.
Definitely. I love Jacksonville. This is a wonderful city to live in. one of my favorite places in the world. But is Jacksonville a Four Seasons hotel kind of destination? The clientele that that hotel requires is going to expect a certain level of entertainment and dining options, and probably a more urban core as we traditionally think of one. I think that Mr. Khan, maybe that's what he's imagining in the future, but that is not reality. He's currently asking for $250 million on a project that just this week the City Council Auditor's Office, as you pointed out, says will not return the kind of ROI to us of $1.69 per dollar, and in fact it would be a loser with a 44 cent per dollar spent return to Jacksonville. And not he's also not promising not to ask for public incentives for the Four Seasons Hotel project. I think that what the city is neglecting to do, and what maybe we're starting to see some effort to do, perhaps led by Councilman Carlucci, is to look at this as a negotiation instead of just, oh, here's what he wants, let's just try to give it to him. Shad Khan is a businessman. He is giving us an offer, and what in most situations, what you will see is a counteroffer. And what seems to happen again and again with him is that he says, I want this, and it's either they just give it to him or they don't give him anything. And how does that help us? I mean, certainly a lot of us would agree that increased development in that part of downtown could benefit the city. It could be an economic driver. It could bring jobs.
Sure.
Tax revenues.
And that's the argument for this whole development. And Fred, what about Claire's point? Should the city take a slightly tougher stance, demand a lease extension, for example, on the Jaguar Stadium lease that expires in 10 years? And if the Lot J project is going to succeed, you definitely need an NFL team there in that footprint.
Well, I mean, the shorter answer is yes. But when you say the city, who is the city? Who is going to make this proposal? It certainly obviously is not going to be the mayor's office, because he has not expressed a vision for downtown or for that area other than what the biggest bankroller for political campaigns right now has proposed. Is it going to be the Downtown Investment Authority? Is this really part of downtown? Is it within their purview? So you're left with the city councilmen who are overseeing that district, the at-large councilmen who have some purview over all of Jacksonville, who are elected by all of Jacksonville, such as Councilman Carlucci, to propose something that makes some kind of sense to what Claire has indicated here. I mean, what if you're going to put in a Four Seasons hotel in the metropolitan park area that you're proposing there? What are those people going to do when they come to this hotel? I mean, what are they going to do? And what is lacking here continued, especially for the last now 6 years? We don't have a vision anymore for what we want Jacksonville to be, and particularly for those few square miles of downtown, what we would like to land, other than what Conland is proposing for us proposing to be there. It's just not right. And again, for us to be a Republican, conservative-dominated politically area, where they say that every person, the businessman, should be able to propose what he want and pay for what he want, and the only thing we're giving them is tax breaks. Here we are basically going to fund somebody else's vision for what they want us to be with no questions asked. It's just not right, and I think that's how most people feel about this deal.
The polling does show 70% of voters do not like the idea of this much in public funds going toward the deal. That said, you said, what would people do if they stay at the Four Seasons? Let's assume Lot J gets built. They could cross the street and go to live music, restaurants, bars, etc. Mosh has released new renderings showing that they plan to build a new museum on the North Bank, right by where the Four Seasons would go. Although, as you reported, David Bauerlein, all of these new plans do not show a new convention center in this whole planned development area. Lots of comments on Facebook. Susan writes, I love downtown Jacksonville, but if Four Seasons, come on, he probably means the landscaping. I think that's a reference to our recent election. Here's a tweet from a listener. We need a master plan, not a patchwork approach to everything. A master plan with focus on the long term, he says. Who could this planning entity be? Well, theoretically, it's the Downtown Investment Authority. But as yet, they have not been given oversight over this deal, which is raising new questions. Let's get a few more of your calls on. Jim in Jacksonville. Go ahead, Jim.
Yes, I say build it. And there's a lot to do in the Four Seasons. In case, I know Fred Matthews said was there to do. There's plenty to do. So I say build it. It seems like every time somebody wants to do something downtown, you always have naysayers, you know, wanting their house painted, or they want something to do with climate change, or there's something in the community. I don't understand why that's always the case. When I moved here in 2006, there was this big argument about the courthouse. And now look at it. You know, it's a sprawling, nice-looking courthouse. I'm sure if this gets built down there, it will revitalize that area. And I say City Council, Sean Kahn, build it. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks for that. John in Bay Meadows. Go ahead, John.
How you doing, Miss Melissa?
All right.
I've been here all my life. I'm 47 years old, and I grew up in the Blodgett Homes, the old Blodgett Homes in the Brentwood area and in downtown area. The downtown area has been systematically did where it does not produce any economics. Number one, the first thing that the city needs to do, which they had all the land out there by the P-Farm, they need to close down that jail and put it out by the P-Farm. I actually built and redid the work that was done on the Berkman Plaza. Now, you got penthouses that's for sale up there, $2.5 million, $3 million. But guess what their view is? Their view is the jail. So that's why the properties down there are not prospering, because Jacksonville, before we came to this new, we want to do something with Jacksonville, it was basically a police state. And they made the mass majority of their money in this city off of the jail, and they put it right downtown. They
okay.
need to
yeah.
move that.
I hear you, John. David Bauerlein, the jail is right down the street from where all this really shiny new development is planned to go. It's my understanding that moving the jail would just be so prohibitively expensive that it's not a realistic possibility. Although, as John points out, it certainly is a drag on these kinds of visions.
So Jim Pigott reported that he talked to Lori Boyer, who's the CEO of the Downtown Investment Authority, yesterday, that one of the possible sites they'd be looking at for a new convention center is, in fact, the site of the current jail. So, you know, there's a lot of different things in play. It would cost, if you want to move the jail and put it somewhere up on the north side, it's $400 to $500 million to build a new jail. A new convention center would cost several hundred million dollars. So huge price tags for those. And just to widen the lens out, you know, then there's talk about upgrades for the stadium, which may be a covered roof that's retractable. So that's add a few hundred million dollars. You got a couple hundred million dollars in Lot J.
Hey, if we're going to spend a couple hundred mil, Mike Mendenhall, what's a few hundred mil more? I'm joking.
Yeah, it's, I mean, you know, this is to open the checkbook, but, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the proposal for shipyards in Met Park that was introduced yesterday, I mean, it's not like technically linked to the Lot J project as far as the financial deal that's going before City Council is concerned. But when Mark Lamping introduced that deal at the DIA committee meeting yesterday, he specifically stated that you know, any request by Sean Kahn for public investment on the shipyard's project would be significantly reduced if the Lot J deal went through. So, you know, essentially saying to the City Council and the DIA, hey, you guys approve this, we're not going to ask you for as much money for the shipyards. But again, that's still, it's still, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions more dollars of public investment. And it is more, I mean, the plan that he produced is more than just the Four Seasons. Like Melissa, you alluded to, there's restaurants, there's bars, but then there's also a medical facility, an orthopedic medical facility that would be there, and a potential public park, an additional residential. So, I mean, there is a lot more to that deal than just the Four Seasons, but the question still remains, you know, will the taxpayers in Jacksonville feel that it's worth it to spend their dollars?
Alan on the south side. Go ahead, Alan. Thanks for holding.
Hey, Melissa, you're great. And I want to say God bless you, Curtis, on the north side. I've got 3 points. One is that it strikes me as strange that the amount of money here is about the same as the JEA deal that fell through. The $6 billion, 5% of $6 billion is $300 million. And that would be like the amount of money that the politicians could align their pockets with. And hey, Melissa, don't you think it's strange? When did the JEA deal fall through? Oh, Curry and the head of JEA were going to be deposed, and the head of JEA, he resigned, and Curry was never deposed. Melissa, you know the three words that strikes fear in the hearts of lawyers everywhere?
Go ahead and say
deposed.
It.
You're being deposed. Okay.
So, all right,
okay,
Alan.
Well, so now it strikes me strange. So here we're talking about, what, $250 million plus $200 million they're going to borrow. That's $450 million. Well, that's on the order of that $300 million that they were going to line their pockets with to begin with. Okay, and then one other thing, and this harks to Curtis's point the other day. Imagine if they do go through with this development, and then all of a sudden there's all these flooding problems. Guess what? Oh, all of a sudden, there's all kinds of money to take care of the flooding problems with the Lot J development, but still, Riverside doesn't get any money. Moores Creek, they don't get any money. They're still flooding just like they always did. Okay.
All right, Alan. Claire, Fred, our callers are following every twist and turn of this. I am so impressed with how civically engaged everybody out there is. And Claire, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, your caller, in a very amusing fashion, makes a lot of points that we are all looking at. And I know I was thinking about the jail. It might be a little bit expensive to move it, but why don't we just maybe redecorate it? We could just paint it Jaguars teal and gold.
There you go.
It would be less of an eyesore,
And we're almost out of time. Fred, with just 20 seconds left, your final thoughts.
Oh boy, redecorate it. I like that. Look, nobody has any problem with Mr. Khan's vision for his area. The only problem we have is that he should pay for it all if he wants to do it.
All right.
The only taxpayer responsibility here is to give him tax breaks on the land that he occupies since the city owns it.
We'll continue to follow it. But thank you, Fred Matthews, Claire Goforth, Mike Mendenhall, and David Bauerlein. And just for you guys, here's a little Four Seasons cut to take us into the weekend. How about that?
All right.
We'll be right back.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Distracted driving is deadly. Teens, yes, but adults too, and there are millions more adults than teens. Arrive alive. Let's end distracted driving.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
On the next Science Friday, how do you distribute a vaccine that needs to be stored at 100 degrees below zero? Just one of the challenges presented by the Pfizer vaccine announced this week. Angela Rasmussen and Natalie Dean discuss why, to cover the whole country, other vaccines will be necessary. A vaccine reality check on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
A new vaccine could bring new hope as COVID cases soar. And as lawsuits continue to fly, a plea to the president to face facts.
Sir, you need to take a step back.
Also, is the ACA safe? The Supreme Court sends out a signal. All of that on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, we're pleased to announce that WJCT, in partnership with Vistar Credit Union, Suddeth, and the Tom Bush Family of Dealerships, has launched our 18th annual Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive. Now, this beloved community tradition will run through the end of the month. And here's what we're doing. We're going to collect new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets and donate them to nonprofits across Northeast Florida. Our CEO, David McGowan, is on the line with more about this. Hi, David.
Hi, Melissa. It's great to be with you this morning.
Great to talk to you. And this is that time of year when we do something that the community always enjoys getting out and supporting, our Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive. It celebrates the memory of Fred Rogers, of course, but it also really helps this community. Can you share with everyone how it's going to work this year?
Absolutely. And we know that this community has a big heart, and this is a great opportunity to show it. This is our 18th year of running what we call the Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive, and we do that to honor that famous public media icon, Mr. Rogers, who's a symbol of generosity and neighborliness. And so we are going to be distributing sweaters and all kinds of lightly used and new garments that the community contributes, and people can contribute those garments at all kinds of places, at any Vistar Credit Union branch in the region, right here at WJCT at 100 Festival Park Avenue, at any of the Tom Bush Family of Dealerships, or at Suddeth Moving locations. And there will be a marked box there, and people can come and drop off their lightly used garments or anything, really, that they think may be useful to our regional homeless population. And those will be distributed then at nonprofits like the Clara White Mission, City Rescue Mission, and the Sulzbacher Center. You know, last year, Melissa, we distributed more than 15,000 garments. So it's really a successful thing that we've been doing for 18 years, and we're very pleased to do it again.
Yeah, I mean, we are in Florida, of course. We're not dealing with 20 below temperatures. But this being said, if you're on the streets or even if you are housed, you do need cold weather necessities. This is something. This is an easy way everyone can help out, too. This is such an easy thing to do.
It is. It's an easy thing to do, especially in these COVID times. It's very easy to come by and drop off things. And I'll tell you, you're right. It's not, you know, we're not in Minnesota. But I had the honor of attending one of our distribution events that we did last year, and it was a frightfully cold day, I can tell you. Those days do happen, and if you are a person who doesn't have reliable shelter during the winter months, or of course any time, you know, the weather has a huge impact on you. So this is a great chance for people to show how they care. It's very easy to do. It takes, you know, just a short amount of time, and we appreciate everyone's help because we have been able to make a really pretty big impact. And I do want to also mention that we are combining this year this event with another event that we name after Mr. Rogers called Be My Neighbor Day. That's usually a big event that we have here at the WJCT facility where we invite really the whole community. We usually entertain thousands of children and young families. This year in the spring, of course, as you can imagine, we had to cancel that event, but we are going to be distributing along with the clothing that people contributed. We're going to be distributing backpacks that are suitable for kids, all kinds of great stuff in there, some school supplies, some fun game activities and other things for young children who might otherwise not be able to have those things in their lives. So that's a way that this year that we're kind of combining these two events.
Very nice. Now, everyone just go to WJCT.org and find out how you can participate in our Mr. Rogers Neighborhood Sweater Drive. It's not just sweaters, though. If you have any kind of piece of clothing or cold weather necessity that you'd like to drop off, like a blanket, you can do that at WJCT, at Sudeth locations, at all Vistar Credit Union locations across Duval, St. John's, Clay, Putnam, Nassau, and Bradford counties. You can also do it at all of the Tom Bush dealership locations in Jacksonville and in Orange Park. Lots of places to do this, David. Easy
to do.
That's
right. That's right. And you can get a full list of all those addresses and locations if you go onto wjct.org/events. You can find this there, and all that information is right there for you.
Thanks so much. Our CEO, David McGowan, on the line. And again, this runs through November 30th. So do what you can. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. We love your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to join us today at noon on the Florida Roundup. That's our live statewide call-in program where we round up the biggest stories across the Sunshine State. The Florida Roundup today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. Have a great weekend. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday for this show. And in the meantime, everyone, keep wearing your masks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.